Hey everyone, welcome back to this week's episode of The Greek Current. I'm Thanos, and this week we're pleased to welcome fellow podcaster, historian, author, and professor Barry Strauss to The Greek Current. Barry, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Thanos. It's a pleasure to be here.
Professor Strauss is an expert on ancient military history who has written and edited numerous books, including The Battle of Salamis, which was in fact named one of the best books of 2004 by the Washington Post, and The Trojan War, A New History. He's published op-ed pieces in the Washington Post, in LA Times, USA Today, Newsday, The Wall Street Journal. He's been interviewed on NPR and BBC. His latest endeavor includes a podcast, which he hosts, that focuses on ancient Greek history called Antiquitas, and not only ancient Greek history, which I think everybody should head over and subscribe to. Again, welcome to the podcast, Barry.
Thank you.
We've kicked off an initiative here at HALC to give Greek this Christmas, and whether it's Greek products or books about Greece and its history. And we've created this crowdsourced database where people can go in and enter links to their favorite Greek business or bookstores, et cetera. You get the vibe. As you can imagine, we obviously think your books would make an ideal gift for this Christmas season.
Well, thanks. I agree.
So we're looking to do a lot of programming around Homer. And I think this conversation we're going to have, we should kick off with a look at your book, The Trojan War, A New History. So there have been tons of books, films. Troy was a big blockbuster film on the topic of the Iliad. There's even a series on Netflix that focuses on the Trojan War. So what inspired you to tackle this endeavor and take on Homer?
Well, I was inspired by the archaeological excavations in the 1990s and the aughts of this century, which really revolutionized our knowledge of ancient Troy, because for the first time they found evidence of the lower city of Troy. And they also found some archaeological artifacts that we hadn't seen before. They found the first Bronze Age writing at Troy. But around the same time, there were some new Hittite documents found, and perhaps more important, reinterpretation of old Hittite documents that strengthened the evidence of an old theory, greatly strengthened the evidence of an old theory of diplomatic correspondence between the Hittites and the Greeks.
Walk us back one second and explain to our listeners who the Hittites are, because I'm not sure everybody's familiar.
Absolutely. So the Hittites were the greatest power of ancient Anatolia, what's nowadays Turkey. Their capital city was near at a place called Hattusha, which is actually near modern Ankara, so in central Anatolia. They don't appear in Homer. They're kind of lost in Homer. But in the late Bronze Age, they were the great power of the Aegean region. Except for them, the Aegean was kind of an annoyance. It wasn't their main focus. Their main focus was to the south. They were interested in Syria. They were heading towards Egypt. They were fighting in the Levant. But the Greeks kept coming. The Mycenaean Greeks kept coming across the Aegean Sea and drew the Hittites into conflict in western Anatolia on the Aegean coast.
The archaeological evidence for the Hittites, how does that play into our new history of the Trojan War?
Well, it's sure. So these are documents. They were originally written on clay, and they survived because they were burnt in fires, destruction fires. And we've got lots and lots and lots of them. The Hittites were extremely literate and sophisticated. And among the documents they've left us are diplomatic correspondence. And we've got diplomatic correspondence between the Hittite king and the king of, Ahiyawa is what it's called in the Hittite documents. In the Homeric equivalent of that, many scholars think, and I agree with them, I'd say most scholars think, is the Homeric equivalent is Achaea. So the people of Ahiyawa were the people who Homer calls the Achaeans, and who we today would call the Mycenaeans, or at least one great kingdom of the Mycenaeans. This particular diplomatic correspondence tells us a few things. It tells us, first of all, that the king of Ahialwa was a great king and recognized as an equal by the Hittite kings. That immediately raises the status of the Mycenaean Greek kingdoms considerably. It also tells us that they were quarreling over control of the northern Aegean and its islands, which is more evidence to bring the Greeks into the world of Anatolia and to bring the Greeks into the region of Troy. So that is really quite exciting to have that evidence.
A lot of these epics, Homer's Iliad especially, it's shrouded in myth.
When
we see like the gods taking sides to influence the outcome of the war when we read it, or the monsters that Odysseus faces on his return to Ithaca. Given this new archaeological evidence, though, how does that change the narrative of the Iliad? And I think another question that many of us might have is, how difficult was it for you to find historical evidence to weave this new story of the Trojan War?
Great questions. Sorry to interrupt.
No problem.
Okay, great questions. So I think that even the most skeptical scholars have long been willing to concede, sure, there was a Trojan War. It was probably no great shakes. So when I was in graduate school in the 1970s, the common wisdom was there was of course a Troy, and it existed in the period that Homer seems to be writing about, but by then it was well past its prime. And any Greek expedition to Troy would probably not have been a big deal because Troy wasn't worth fighting for. That was the conclusion of the latest excavations. They were done in the 1930s, but because of World War II, they weren't published until quite a bit later. So when I was a graduate student, people really poo-pooed the Trojan War. Yeah, it might have happened, but not really significant.
Yeah, great story, but...
Right. The equivalent of some minor skirmish on the frontier. Well, these new excavations between the late 1980s and until quite recently have shown that actually Troy was a great city. It wasn't a small place. The phrase that was used, as I recall from my graduate school days, was that Homer's Troy was in its quote-unquote squatter phase. But we now know that it wasn't in any squatter phase at all. As I said, you know, what Schliemann, the famous Schliemann, found at Troy was basically the citadel, the Acropolis, if you will, of ancient Troy. Nobody could find the lower city. And to be anything like what Homer described, you need a lower city because the Acropolis is just too small. Imagine if all we had of ancient Athens was the Acropolis. We couldn't say, well, that's a great city. Well, what these new excavators found is they found evidence, mostly pottery evidence of the lower city, and they found evidence of a wooden palisade and a trench that surrounded the lower city. It's very difficult to find the lower city because it was built on bedrock, and the soil, whatever was there, has washed away over the ages. Troy's also a place that has been plundered by tourists, even some high-class tourists like Julius Caesar and Augustus.
Well, Alexander the Great, famously.
And Alexander, of course, was one of the early prominent tourists who came to Troy. So it's understandable that there might be less left of ancient Troy than we would like. But I think these new excavations are just terrific, and they really demonstrate that Troy was a great city. Needless to say, academics quarrel with each other, and there is a minority opinion that is not convinced. But I'm certainly convinced, and I think most scholars are. Still, there are plenty of scholars who would say, okay, we'll give you Troy, but a Trojan War, I don't know. If there was a war around Troy, then surely it had nothing to do with the description in Homer, and perhaps it was a matter of trade quarrel, or perhaps it was part of the general disruptions that took place in the Aegean world in the Eastern Mediterranean around 1200 BC that had nothing to do with a stolen bride and a quarrel between Sparta on the one hand, Lacedaemon, let's say, and Troy on the other hand. And to those people, I would say, you know, we have to be careful I think it's fair enough to say that what we're getting in Homer is a mythologized picture from a world that tended to think in personal and mythologized terms. But we shouldn't go to the other extreme of trying to explain ancient history in our own categories and our own terms. And I'll give you just one example.
Sure.
Nowadays, we would consider it an outrageous abuse of power if an American president said we should go to war because he had personally been insulted or because his family had been insulted. But in the Bronze Age, the only acceptable explanation for a war was personal. In the Bronze Age, people did not think in abstract terms. They only thought in personal terms. And we know this because we have plentiful archives of diplomatic correspondence from the ancient Near East from this period that makes clear that this is the way people would justify war. Basically, all the explanations of warfare in the ancient world boil down to a single phrase: he dissed me. And that's why people went to war. So for Homer to say, you know, the Greeks went to war because the king of Lacedaemon had been insulted by a member of the royal family of Troy and he stole his wife, that would make perfect psychological sense as an explanation to the people of 1200 BC.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And it leads me into my next question, I think. Like you mentioned, we've obviously discovered the ruins at Troy. We've discovered the ruins of the Mycenaean city.
Yes.
And we've seen these diplomatic correspondence now that you've had the chance to examine.
Right.
How much of our story is in fact myth and how much is history? I mean, is Odysseus and Agamemnon and the other, you know, great kings that we read about in the Iliad, are they historical figures?
Okay, good question. I think first answer is to say we don't know. Can't prove it. We haven't found any smoking guns, mm-hmm. like an inscription saying here lies Agamemnon or something like that. And yet, for one thing, well, we know that part of the story of the Iliad was passed down by oral tradition because we know that writing disappeared from the Greek mainland and the islands for several centuries. Writing didn't disappear from Western Anatolia. We don't have any Greek writing, but we have writing in other languages. And there's even some reason to think the Trojans themselves wrote a poem about the destruction of Troy, because Troy was rebuilt. There might have been a Trojan Iliad. So some of the names could have come down. Second point, names, we know from the study of oral traditions throughout history and different civilizations that names are the one thing that people tend to remember. And they tend to pass the names down from generation to generation. Third point, we should not assume that people in ancient times didn't care about the past and didn't care about history. They did care about the past and they did care about history. So it would have been very important for the people in ancient Greece to remember their past and their traditions. Next point. We have a lot of documents from Bronze Age Greece. They're written in not written in the Greek alphabet, which hadn't been invented yet, but they're written in a syllabary, a collection of syllables, which you probably know is called Linear B. Mm-hmm. Linear B is Greek. It's nothing other than Greek. It's the Greek language. It was deciphered in the 1950s by various cryptographers. And one of the really interesting things about Linear B is that a lot of the names in Homer appear in Linear B.
Okay.
Very few of the names of people in Homer were later used in classical Greece. I mean, there just weren't a lot of people running around Periclean Athens named Achilles or Odysseus. But we do find names like that in the Linear B texts. The Linear B texts are mostly tax records. They're a little disappointing for people who wanted to find poetry. But they're mostly tax records. But they do have the names of people in Homer. There's no evidence that these are the names of the names that are used by people in Homer. There's not a document that says King Agamemnon decree. So we don't have that.
Yet.
And that's a really good point because more of these documents are being found all the time. And that's important to keep in mind. So Yes, we don't have them yet. Another point that I wanted to make is that the art historical evidence is just so stunning from Bronze Age Greece.
Right. It's not just the oral tradition and the linear B, like you said, and the diplomatic correspondence, but there's loads of pottery and art that depicts all these scenes.
That depicts scenes, that depicts heroic scenes, the kinds of scenes that you'd find in epic. And finally, I should say, we just don't want to make the mistake that I think a lot of people make, which is think that people in the past weren't as smart as us. They were really smart. And we have to keep that in mind. We say, oh, they were primitive. They weren't primitive. They were very sophisticated. We also make the mistake of thinking, wow, 1200 BC, that's so long ago. Nobody knew nothing then. But actually, civilization begins around 3500 BC. By 1200 BC, civilization was over 2,000 years old. So people had been around the block. Mm-hmm. They were pretty sophisticated by those times.
Definitely. And I think these are some of the things that you discuss in depth on your podcast, which we mentioned in the beginning of our episode, called Antiquitas.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about why you decided to start this project.
Great.
And well, then we'll dive into our discussion on the first couple episodes.
Sure. Well, the subtitle is Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World. And I have a real interest in leadership, so I wanted to highlight that. And although I mostly talk about historical characters, I also talk about legendary characters, because I think they're an important part of the story and an important part of people's historical memories. I wanted to do the podcast because I think podcast is really a growing form of communications. And there's a real interest in people who can bridge the gap between popularizers and professors. And I think there's a great niche for scholars who have the academic background, but who also enjoy talking to a wider audience. And for people who are both scholars and communicators, both professors and popularizers, so who could reach out, but had the scholarly chops to be able to back up what they had to say, and who really knew where they were coming from. So that was what I saw as the potential. And I also wanted to challenge myself. Some of the material in the podcast is material that I used in teaching, but I wanted to think, well, what's the transition like between the lecture room to the microphone? And it's been an interesting challenge.
Yeah, the first two episodes, in fact, they touch on what we've been talking about for on this podcast, a deep dive on Achilles, and who you, in fact, describe at one point as the LeBron James of Greek warfare.
Yes.
And Helen of Troy. Why kick off with these two characters? And, I mean, what are the lessons that we should carry with us from each in terms of leadership?
Well, Achilles is one of the saddest but most fascinating characters in history. He really is like LeBron James. He's an absolute master and indeed an artist at what he does.
From Chicago, I'm going to a little bitter that you didn't choose Michael Jordan, but
I'm sorry. We can. You know, there's a touch of Michael Jordan there. Michael Jordan there as well. But you know, Achilles is inspiring, but he's also a cautionary tale, because the Iliad is the story of the education of Achilles, and Achilles learns, it's the bitter education of Achilles. He learns that the world is a whole lot more complicated than he thought, and a whole lot sadder than he thought. Achilles is the vessel by which Greek civilization gave the world the gift of tragedy. And I guess some people would say some gift, but it is a gift, because it allows us to understand that life, that suffering is a part of life, that life isn't always easy. And that the real question is, what are you going to make of suffering? What are you going to do with suffering? And I think Achilles gives us the classic answer as to what to do with suffering. And He leads people not only by being a berserker in battle, but by being a human being and somebody who has a heart. And one of the most memorable moments in all of literature is when Achilles welcomes King Priam, the father of his archenemy, the man he has killed, the father of Hector, when Achilles welcomes him to his tent, and the two of them cry together over the human condition and the suffering of humanity. And Achilles gives in to Priam's request that Achilles turn over the body of his son for decent burial at Troy. So, I mean, I think Achilles it starts out being a lesson in egotism, and he ends up being a lesson in humility. So I think there's something for all leaders to learn in that.
Let's look at Helen of Troy as well, because you dedicate an entire episode to her.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are two ways of looking at Helen. On the one hand, Helen she's not just a pretty face. She is extremely astute and extremely knowledgeable about doing what it takes to survive. She gets out of a bad marriage, an unhappy life in Sparta or Lacedaemon. She builds a new life for herself at Troy. But when she has to go back to Lacedaemon, when she's caught by her husband, who she has betrayed, she manages to talk her way out of it and to go back and be a successful queen in Lacedaemon again. So she is a lesson as to what it takes to survive and how sometimes it's not entirely a pretty picture. The second side of Helen is that Helen represents, well, inspiration and desire. And Helen is a reminder that if you want to get people to do things, if you as a leader want to get people to follow you, it's not enough to say, hey, do it for the money, do it for the profit, do it for the goodies. You have to give them an ideal. You have to say you're struggling, you're fighting for something bigger than any of us, something more important. And Helen represents that. Helen represents beauty itself. You know, Helen represents something for which men will die, maybe not even knowing why entirely while they'll do it. But it moves people, and people are moved by more than simple
material gains. Yeah,
they're moved by more than material gain. They're moved by inspiration. And I think Helen reminds us that. So I think that Homer is teaching us something profound with the character of Helen.
There's great material. I'll let people get the meat of the substance by listening to your podcast. So everybody should go and subscribe to Antiquitas and start listening to Barry Strauss's episodes, Achilles, Helen of Troy, Leonidas, Pericles. I want to pivot now and talk about what's in store for the future. You've masterfully taken on Herodotus in the Battle of Salamis. A book that we were able to break down together, actually, at one of our HALC events here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
You've tackled Homer with the Trojan War.
Right.
And you're currently preparing a new book that's going to be released in March titled 10 Caesars, Roman Emperors from Augustus to Constantine.
Yes.
This is much less shrouded in myth.
Yes.
And more in history,
mm-hmm.
As we understand it today.
Mm-hmm.
So what can we expect from the newest book coming out? And then I want to dive in and examine how these emperors, in fact, shaped the development of Greek history.
Sure. So, anyone who writes about the Roman emperors is going to have a lot of fun. There are great stories. We all know from TV and the movies that there are incredible stories of divine decadence about the Roman emperors, and that is absolutely there. And I hope my readers will agree that the book is fun and lively, because I think it's hard to do otherwise when writing about the subject. But there's also, I think, the story of the Roman Empire is a profound reflection about what it takes to run a big, diverse, multicultural, powerful society. So I hope the readers will take away lessons as well. And I think the book will give us all food for thought about change in large, diverse, multi-ethnic societies, and how you cope with change.
Awesome. In the book, you examine these Roman emperors, and obviously Rome ruled what is today Greece and the Greek-speaking world. How did these emperors shape and move Greek history forward?
So, of course, we think of Roman history as Roman history, but in fact, the Roman Empire was a condominium. It was a joint enterprise between Romans and the people they conquered, and no one more so than the Greeks. Greek was, in effect, the second language of the Roman Empire and the language of the Roman East. We think of the Roman Empire as the Roman Empire, but in fact, it would more accurately be known as the Greco-Roman Empire. Greek was the main language of the eastern part of the empire, and Greek was also the language of culture and education of the Roman elite. It's been pointed out that Rome was either the largest or the second largest Greek-speaking city of the ancient world after Alexandria, because there were so many Greek speakers who lived in Rome. And many, if not most, of the emperors were knowledgeable in Greek. They could read it or speak it. They had studied it. Augustus, for instance, was proud of his knowledge of Greek. Among the emperors is somebody who's written one of the great classics of Greek literature, Marcus Aurelius, the Meditations. We forget that the Meditations was written not in Latin, but Greek. And two of the emperors in particular are just titanic figures in the history of ancient Greece. Hadrian, who loved Greece and spent a lot of time in Athens, kind of wanted to raise Athens to be an unofficial capital of the Eastern Roman Empire and rebuilt the city of Athens. As you know, if you go to Athens today, many of the antiquities we see were built by Hadrian. And Constantine, one of the most important figures in all of Greek history, founder of the city of Constantinople, founder of the Orthodox faith, the first Christian emperor, an enormously important figure in the history of ancient Greece. So the Roman emperors have a lot to say about the Greeks as well.
We're excited for March then, for this book to come out so we can get our hands on it. I want to finish off with a look at leadership. Professor, you're an authority on the subject of leadership and the lessons that can be learned from the experiences of these great political and military leaders, primarily in the ancient world. What are the most profound lessons that stand out to you from your research of whether it's the Trojan War, whether it's Themistocles and the battle against the Persians? Or the Roman emperors. Now, is there a common theme that you've noticed that you can kind of leave us with?
Yeah. Well, one theme is that it's lonely to be a leader. It's very lonely to be a leader. You might have all the advisors and helpers in the world, but in the end, I'd say at the end of the day, except it's more like 2 a.m, you've got to take tough decisions on your own. So you've got to be raised, I think, from childhood to be courageous, to be strong, and to be willing to take the heat for tough decisions. There's not really a leadership gene, but there's a certain type of person who can do that. And you know it when you see that person. It's really remarkable how you know it when you see that person, often at a rather early age. And that's one of the reasons why people can be pretty good at deciding who's a leader and who's not a leader. The more I write about leaders, think about leaders, and encounter leaders in my own life, the more impressed I am by the degree to which leaders almost have an aura of leadership. By the same token, you've got to be a good listener. Leaders have to be decisive, but it's not a good idea to shoot from the hip. You have to listen from others. You have to take in information, absorb it, know when to change, know when you've made a mistake, know when you need to take a different course, and you have to quickly move. So it's a tremendously difficult thing to do to be a leader. And I think that maybe one other common denominator about these stories is that it's really good to read stories of great leaders. I think Plutarch was right. If you want to educate people to do great things, you need to give them examples from the past And I think we can constantly learn from these examples. They're evergreen cases.
And on that note, I want to thank you, Professor Strauss, for taking the time and speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Encourage everybody to go on Amazon or visit your library or your bookstore, your local bookstore, and pick up whether it's the Trojan War, A New History, or the Battle of Salamis. I guarantee you will not be disappointed, and you might learn a thing or two from Professor Strauss. So thank you again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that wraps up this week's episode of The Greek Current. Tune in again next week. Thanks.